OT After Dark is a podcast run by two occupational therapists and is for adults only. The views on this podcast are our own and are intended for information and educational purposes only. We believe that sex and sexual pleasure are a human right for consenting adults, regardless of ability, age, gender, or sexual orientation. We discuss topics that cover a wide variety of sex and sexual practices. To be true to our strong views regarding inclusivity, we use common and slang terms regarding sexual topics, which may be considered explicit. Listener discretion is advised.
We have exciting news to share. We recently partnered with DirectRec, a free app for OT practitioners, PT practitioners, and speech-language pathologists.
DirectRec helps clinicians to find peer-vetted products, and we recently have added our own recommendations of products on DirectRec for sexual health and wellness.
We helped DirectRec get a little extra sexy. DirectRec helps clinicians share products and other digital info, like YouTube videos and Google Docs, with their clients.
DirectRec helps you to track clients' follow-through on your product recommendations. So to start using DirectRec, click on the link on our website at otafterdark.com or in our social media bios.
Hi, I'm Kay.
And I'm JJ.
And we're both occupational therapists.
And we're here talking to you about sex.
Tell everybody who we have today.
We have Sue Newsom, who is a sex and relationship therapist as well as a sex surrogate.
This is going to be a good one.
Listen in. So today we'd like to welcome Sue Newsom, who is a sex and relationship therapist as well as a sex surrogate. Welcome, Sue. We are so happy to have you here on OT After Dark.
Hello, and thank you very much for the opportunity of being part of your podcast.
So Sue, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, your work, and what you do with individuals with disabilities?
Okay, so I started in this field back in 2001. It's actually my second career. My first career was in the world of IT. And then I retrained to work as a sex and relationship therapist. So I started working with clients, both individuals and couples. And back in 2009, I was approached by someone who runs a charity in the UK. And the charity is called The Outsiders. And it's specifically focused on supporting people who have disability to find relationship, find friendship, and find sexual satisfaction. That is what they do. And they've been contacted by one of their members. And this was a male who was, he'd been involved in an accident, and he had lost capacity from his neck down. So he was a tetraplegic or a quadriplegic, as you might say. And he'd seen some research that had been conducted in the US, which had described how men with a spinal cord injury, how they had been able to experience an orgasmic response in their body. And he was really curious about this because he had an accident. That's what had created his disability. And prior to having the accident, he'd had a very active sex life. He then had the accident, and it had caused, you know, it was a high level of on his thing. And he went through, I think it was between 18 months and 2 years of rotation. Was there any consideration for his sexual response? You know, it wasn't even talked about. And the rehabilitation meant that he could return to live home independently. So he got his own, you know, residence, and he had a care team. It was a 24/7 care team, because he needed to use a ventilator to breathe. Mm-hmm. And so when I was asked whether I'd be interested to support this client, I had a real curiosity. I mean, I was nervous about it. because it was new territory for me. But I really wanted to see if I could help. So that was the start of me working with people who have physical disability. And that work has continued to the present day. And I mean, with that particular client, I went to his where he lived. And the first thing that happened, which I was completely unprepared for, you know, we'd agreed that we'd have the first meeting, which was a discussion, which was just a getting to know each other type of session. And for me to start to, you know, carry out, you know, ask questions in terms of assessing level of risk and safety and all of that. But his two members of his care team wanted to be in on that meeting, which I hadn't ever come across before. I was used to meeting, you know, primarily client. But of course they wanted to meet, because who was this woman who they'd never met before coming in to talk to their client about sex? Mm-hmm. You know, so that was new. But I've learned in this field of my work how, in most cases, yes, I am approached, you know, the inquiry comes from a client, but part of my work is also about working with some of their care team. Going back to my first client, we spent a number of sessions establishing communication. And I was, you know, working very hard to make sure that he was absolutely, you know, he was in consent, that this was all about him being in control, you know, him really, you know, being able to communicate about what was okay, what was not okay. And then we, the multi-sensory experience. And basically what that was that from where he got hypersensitivity, we developed a whole series of touch experience. And it was him communicating with me about what he wanted. And, you know, so I would, we'd start off with, you know, incredibly light touch, incredibly sensual. And then as he was experiencing, you know, and there was the proximity of my body to his, then he would want much, much more intense touch around the line of his injury, all around his neck, on his face, all over his head. And, you know, also in time, we developed that to include sort of sexy talk as part of it, him and giving him permission to describe what was happening for him, how he felt, you know, what he would like, what fantasies were developing for him in that time. And, you know, we worked on this over a considerable period of time. And part of it was, you know, putting some effort into trying to make the environment a little bit more sexy, because we were working in his bedroom where he lived, which was incredibly clinical because it had got medical equipment in there. And, you know, so I took some time to change the lighting, bring some nice fabrics and stuff, just to change the look and feel of the whole environment. And we got to the stage where he described that what was happening in his body, it felt like an orgasm, but not like the orgasms he had prior to injury, which were very genital based. His description was that something was happening that felt really amazing. It felt like it was happening in his whole body, even though he had paralysis in his body. And he, you know, it just gave him a sense of, wow, I'm not sort of devoid of sexuality here. I actually can exist in my world with a degree of, you know, sort of sexual potency, if you like. Because one of the things I've learned is that when, you know, working with clients with disability, you know, if they're not supported in, you know, expressing their sexual desire, how that can create, you know, such a tension for them. And, you know, that can then lead to, you know, depression or mental health issues if, you know, they're holding this, you know, sort of almost like suffocated desire that they're not in a position to express. And of course, you know, they have close physical contact from members of their care team, you know, on an everyday basis, but then that can, you know, create a lot of confusion for them. So that was my first client with disability, and I have to say it was incredibly challenging, but hugely rewarding. And we were invited to participate in an event at the Royal Society of Medicine, which is an incredibly highbrow organisation in London. And they were doing a whole day around sex and disability. And I was a little bit nervous about going because I thought, well, how is this going to translate? This is such a sensual experience between him and I. What's it going to be like from an audience mm-hmm. point of view? Is it just going to look like me just putting my hands on this man's head, you know? Mm-hmm. And I was a little anxious about that. But, you know, he really wanted to do it because he wanted to talk about what a difference it had made to him. And he wanted to, you know, encourage other professionals to not be frightened of a person's sexuality. You know, he wanted to really advocate this sort of work. So we went ahead with and did it. And we got some amazing feedback. Mm-hmm. So that was, yeah.
Could we take a step back and maybe for our listeners, if you could define the difference in from your point of view between sex therapist and a sex surrogate?
Yeah, certainly. So sex therapy is talking work. Mm-hmm. So it can cover, I mean, you know, even within the field of sex therapy, there are different specialisms. But in general, sex therapy can cover any aspect of adult sexual expression and, you know, anything that, you know, an adult is struggling with in the area of, you know, sexual intimacy, sexual pleasure. Sex surrogacy is a different field of work where it's, so there is obviously still a talking element, but there can be a physical contact element in sex surrogacy. Now, I think the true definition of sex surrogacy is where it came from Masters and Johnson many, many years ago when they had male clients who were not in relationship and didn't have sexual partners. So they provided sex surrogates who were, you know, professional people for them to practice like skills practice with. Mm-hmm. So, you know, practice, you know, were they making any improvement around their erectile dysfunction or their rapid ejaculation, that sort of thing. So that's where sex surrogacy started. I guess in my case, when I'm working with clients with physical disability, there are situations when I feel it is appropriate and the best way forward where I will work in a more facilitative way. So if I give you, you know, so like with this client I've already described, you know, I was touching him. Mm-hmm. You know, I was behaving in some ways like a partner, although I was also being very mindful of my role and of obviously, you know, sort of monitoring mm-hmm. the session and also making sure that, you know, he was absolutely present, you know, he was cognizant and that he was in control. With other clients, I've worked with other male clients where I have been supporting them in their with regards to their masturbation practice. So a current client is a gentleman who has cerebral palsy. And when he first contacted me, again, this was through the charity in the UK, he was feeling incredibly frustrated because he had never he'd never been acknowledged as being sexual. And you know, as often happens with people who are born with a disability, they are, even though they do age and grow up, but that aspect of their growing up is somehow ignored. Mm-hmm. And this was causing him increasing anxiety because his words to me, it is the one part of my body that does work really well, i.e. his sexual response. So he would be getting erections, but they were often considered inappropriate. because they were erections that were happening, you know, when he was a member of the care team, was doing physio on him. And he was completely bewildered about how to be with this. So he took the step of asking for help. So I met with him, and again, number of talking sessions. A lot of it was to do with education and just normalizing what happens around sexual response, and that it's not wrong to have an erection and it's not wrong to have sexual thoughts. But one of the things with this.
Yeah, I think it's fantastic too, because that you mentioned that, you know, people had been telling him, you know, it's inappropriate or this is inappropriate. But is anybody saying when it is appropriate, or what does that look like then? And I think that's where your work comes into play.
Yeah. Absolutely. So with this particular client, it one of the things he got that masturbation was somehow wrong. So we opened up the conversation about masturbation, and what was evident was because of the mobility, his restricted mobility in his hands, that he got a real issue around fatigue. So he could, you know, in terms of pleasuring himself. So once we kind of got masturbation out of the cupboard and sort of shone a light on it and made it, you know, well, this is not a shameful topic and it's not wrong. I then invited him to show me how he masturbated. Mm-hmm. And then we just looking at the basic, you know, the different places of pleasure on the, male genitals. And so how he could use his hands, his fingers, how he could use those more effectively so that he didn't get overly tired, mm-hmm. When he wanted to pleasure himself. And also then the next stage, which we're still working with this, is looking at what devices might also help him. Mm-hmm. You know, we've looked at some that have been specially designed for people with disability. We've looked at some that are sort of generally available. And we're with this client, we're looking at what can ease his masturbation practice. And he's now, you know, he's now more comfortable masturbating. It's not shameful as much as it was. And we're also now looking at trying to source a sex worker. So this is someone who he can build a relationship with, who he can have regular visits from. But, you know, it's taken some time for him to be in a position to be able to clearly articulate what it is, you know, that he would want from a sex worker. Mm-hmm. He feels empowered in that, rather than just organizing that but then feeling dissatisfied at the end of it.
So I have a question. I'm guessing right now, when we air this, people who are listening are going to be wondering about the law and legalities. Yeah. In terms of your work, where there's hands-on, and then when we start talking about sex work, can you speak to that and kind of how the law supports this, or issues that might come up?
Okay, so I can speak to it in terms of the UK. Mm-hmm. So in the UK, someone booking, contacting a sex worker and arranging a visit for a sex worker to their, you know, to their property, or going to a sex worker's property, is not illegal.
Okay, go UK.
Yeah. I can be really, really clear about, and you know, that it is an area of, I mean, it's a very emotive topic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Worldwide.
Yes.
And you know, there is the, because not everyone, you know, is comfortable with the idea or is in agreement with that, mm-hmm. then there is an assumption that it is illegal, because there are some aspects of sex work that, you know, soliciting is illegal. Mm-hmm. Working in a, where sex workers, where there's more than one of them working together, mm-hmm. then that is legal. Mm-hmm. But for a person to contact a sex worker and arrange for a visit, that is absolutely fine. If the other area where that is illegal is if they were to arrange, pay for sexual services with someone who has been trafficked. Yeah, that is. So, but we have to just on that, the charity that I mentioned before, they have, there are two other aspects to their work. One is that they have a an organization called, it's called the Sexual Health and Disability Alliance. And that is, it's a community for any professionals, whether it's a psychotherapist, psychologist, physiotherapist, occupational therapist, people like myself, sex therapists, sex workers, anyone who is working with people with disability and their work is has any sort of aspect of helping them with intimacy, relationship or sexual pleasure. We are part of a professional community, and we meet each, you know, we meet a couple of times a year, so we share, you know, best practice. So that's a real great, and we have, as part of that community, we have access to legal representatives who are always, any questions we might have around legality, then we can, we get, we can get advice from that, that resource, which is great. And then the other aspect of the charity is that they have something called TLC. I think that was Tender Loving Care. That's, and it's effectively, it's a website, or no, it's a directory, and that has on it practitioners who are have experience and are comfortable to work with people with disability. And that's an and that's nationally, so that's in all different geographies in the UK. And that has got on there, you know, that's got it could be, again, it could be a therapist or it could be a sex worker, but someone who specifically you know, they've either, you know, they're prepared to travel to the client's premises, that they're used to, you know, managing situations around disability. So that's, you know, that is a great resource.
Is there a specific I'm in the mind of listeners and questions, especially US listeners. you defined a difference between sex therapist and sex surrogacy. Are there, is there licensure? I'm guessing there's some sort of licensure attached to sex therapy in the UK. I don't know about sex surrogacy.
So there, in terms of when you say licensure, can you just
like,
say
what you
mean?
In the United States, for like an OT, we pass a national, so we have a certain education we need, and we pass a certain exam, and then we're licensed occupational therapists occupational therapy assistants. Is it similar for sex therapy, and then also for sex surrogacy?
Okay, so absolutely, sex therapy. There's a very rigorous, rigorous training, and there is a governing body. For sex surrogacy, that's not as clearly defined. It used to be. So there is an international sex surrogacy organization, which is US based. And that there used to be a UK organization, but that was disbanded when people started to get a little bit more nervous about sex surrogacy. So there's not a UK wide training. It's much more, people do trainings like, there's a training called sexological body work. And that's an international training. And that does equip people to do hands-on work. And there is a governing body for that. And there is, you know, there is insurance for that as well. So there is professional insurance for it.
And then, since you work as both, is there anything you need to do in terms of when you're doing hands-on or not hands-on to kind of document and very, very clearly define those roles?
Absolutely. So in terms of the hands-on work that I do, that is for my clients who have physical disability. So that I am really, really clear about that. I would never, if I'm doing talking work with a client, it would always stay as talking work. Without question, it's absolutely I'm very, very clear, and I have professional supervision in support of that.
Okay, I'll get out of the mind of our listeners. I feel like maybe I've answered questions that are probably out there.
I'd like to hear a little bit more about is, I know you've talked about some of your clients who are men that you've worked with. Yeah. Are you also working with women with physical disabilities or other disabilities as well?
Absolutely. I guess I probably, on balance, I've worked with slightly more male clients with disability than female, but I have worked with female clients with disability who I've met as individual clients. And then I've worked with a significant number of couples who have disability. And those couples, quite a few of them have been where both parties have a disability, but there have been a few couples where it's just one of the couple that has a disability. And, in both cases, it was the female who was disabled.
Could you give us some examples of what that couple work looks like sometimes?
Certainly. So I guess there's quite the theme. I have noticed a theme with my couple's work. If I talk first of all about the couple where one of the party was disabled, this was a couple, and the female, she had multiple sclerosis, obviously a degenerative situation, and they wanted some help managing the fact that they were having to make changes to their sex life. They were having to make these adjustments because they really, really wanted to stay intimate together. They wanted to, maintain that level of physical closeness. But it was how were they going to do that? And then also it was they wanted some help with the possibility that they might at some point move from being closed monogamy to open monogamy, so that the male partner, that he would have more options in terms of his sexual satisfaction. So with this couple, there was the first part of the work was just looking at some of the, just some of the, like, almost like logistics of, they've been used to one position for their lovemaking. Now they were going to have to make an adjustment to that. And how were they, just a bit of creativity, basically, mm-hmm. to bring that in. But then they then did want to talk through and for me to support them, having the conversations about if they were going to move to a open monogamous model, how would that be? Because obviously they had a lot of questions, their hopes and their fears. And so I was very much, being the witness to that and actually supporting them go through that whole process of them sharing their fears, sharing their hopes, and so that if they were going to make that choice, that they'd be making it from a stronger and a clearer place together, rather than just, sort of diving in a bit unconsciously and hoping for the best. So that was that couple. And then the couples where both parties have a disability, I think in all cases that's been where both, they're all heterosexual couples and both of them have cerebral palsy. And I guess because, there are different degrees of cerebral palsy, and it's what's been the consistent question that they've raised and that they've asked for help with is, can we have intercourse? So in all cases these couples had got to the stage where they were very comfortable and very adept at pleasuring each other and being in pleasure together. They'd managed that absolutely brilliantly. But the question about intercourse was an unknown for them. And I think while ever it was an unknown, it was a bit of a drain. It's like, well, are we going to be able to or not? So that's in all cases, that's where I was in. They made an inquiry, and when I first met them, that was the question. So I would, again, spend a considerable amount of time talking to them, you know, understanding their situation and really, you know, developing communication with them. And then it was then getting down to the logistics of, well, understanding what level of mobility they had, things like how much flexibility in their bodies, and then just looking at, well, logistically, can this happen? Mm-hmm. And, you know, if I think about the most recent couple that I worked with, you know, we got to the point where they were happy and comfortable for me to be in the room with them while they, this was in their bedroom, while they showed me how they would attempt to have intercourse, you know, how one of the couple would move their body to get as close as they could to their partner. And that's where, you know, I was witnessing this, so I could then explain to them, you know, what I'd witnessed, how close or not they were, and then look at, so if this is going to happen, how is it going to happen? What's, is this the best position for you to be trying? Is there a better position? What might help, you know, in terms of, you know, bolstering, you know, cushions, mm-hmm. supports, all that sort of thing. And then the other major one is around fatigue, because, you know, what again is going to be feasible from a, you know, an energy point of view. I mean, one of my experiences has been with one couple, that was their question. And I met with them a number of times, and my honest feedback to them was no. I absolutely could not in any way see how they were going to achieve penetration. Mm-hmm. But because we got there, we really explored all sorts of possibilities, even using, you know, a hoist, whether all of that. And I think when we got to the no, there was an element of disappointment for the couple, but they, because we kind of got there together and we had explored everything, there was also a sense of relief.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, we can stop thinking about it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But interestingly, what came out of that, because I guess they felt comfortable with me, one of the couple started to talk about their interest in how they'd always carried a fantasy about domination, but it had only ever been a fantasy, and they'd actually felt quite ashamed about it and quite embarrassed. But this started to emerge. So by the time we got to the point where we had to say, okay, intercourse is not going to happen, they then asked for some advice. Okay, well, how can we realise this fantasy, which they both were so excited about? And we then sourced some bits and pieces to, you know, so whether they could be still in their chair, in their wheelchairs, where one of them could be, they loved a bit of role play, a bit of scenario where one of them was being dominant over the other. And it just, so that that's opened up kind of new opportunities for them, which was, I guess, an unexpected. That wasn't what they were expecting when they first contacted me. And I didn't know that would come out, but I was very, very, very happy and comfortable to support them in that.
A happy ending. Happy ending of sorts. I have a question about payment of services. How does that work for you?
In terms of
how are they? Are they paying their out of pocket? Is it within the health system that it gets covered?
Okay, so they very interesting question. They're paying out of pocket.
Okay.
So they're paying it. They're paying out of their income basically. Mm-hmm. But there is just one of the male clients that I'm working with, he, since he made contact with the charity, his latest, application for his government funding, you know, his benefits package. I think that's, yeah. He included an amount which was for his sexual well-being, and it was agreed.
Oh, excellent.
That's fantastic. That's so exciting.
Because yeah, I know I've been reading more and more about that being included. Mm-hmm. I've read definitely in England, and I think I've read in Australia that's coming up too.
Yeah. So I am not aware of anyone else having made a successful application, because what I am aware of is so where the media have got hold of stories where, let's say, someone who is a resident in a kind of a care home, where they have had the support of the care team to organise for a sex worker to visit, then the media have got hold of that, and that has become, you know, that's become a scandal, basically. Yeah. You know, and then that's caused that whole, you know, situation to have to be terminated, because, you know, the that going out in the local news. So I've heard of a number of stories like that. This was heartening to hear that. Yeah. This application was successful, and I think my understanding is that he got some help with it in terms of how it was, because it, you know, his argument was that this is his well-being. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
it's part of his quality of life. Yeah. and everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's plenty to argue that. The World Health Organization would support that. You could find enough there.
Yes.
Totally. And the, you know, the whole, equal opportunities, you know, it's all, you know, all of that. Yeah. is supportive of, you know, of this. But I guess we could argue that it'd be the same for anybody, that, you know, any support of people's sexual well-being, it's all to do with our overall health, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly.
Any other, I guess I'm curious if there's any other just interesting stories you have from like really like success stories.
Success stories. Well, I guess for me, sometimes, you know, there are those moments when I felt really, really sort of touched by witnessing the progress that a client's made. And so one was a young man with cerebral palsy who his parents, he'd felt very kind of like almost ashamed of his sexuality in front of his parents, because they'd been, you know, they cared for him. And obviously cared for him very intently as from being a baby. And then he was feeling that was becoming a bit more suffocating in terms of his adult sexuality. And so even things like if he was in the room with them and there was any suggestion of something sexual on the TV, they'd switch it off in front of him and all of that. So he made contact, and his parents were quite not happy with him making contact to get some help. I went to meet with him, and luckily he'd got one member of his care team who was totally supportive of him in making, you know, making contact with me. And so him and I started work together. His, again, parents quite skeptical about it. They expected me to be wearing high heels and a miniskirt. I did bump into his mum, and she was surprised that I was wearing just regular clothes. Yeah. I think what's more important is that they witnessed a change in him. And because he was, you know, starting to, rather than avoid the topic of sexual response, he was actually starting to bring that into his conversations. And to the point that he lived independently, but he would stay with his parents quite frequently. And he always felt it was impossible to masturbate when he was in their property. There was something completely wrong about that. And that he would be, you know, he'd be somehow you know, disciplined or punished for that in some way. And when he told me that he'd been over to stay for the weekend and he masturbated in private, but in their house, yeah. It was, that was kind of like, yes, yes.
Yay for masturbation.
Yeah. So, yeah, I guess that was, and another one was quite a few years ago, a woman who, she was a paraplegic, so paralyzed from the waist down, and she just got a few questions around her body image, to do with how, because she'd had an accident that had created the paralysis, and her concern was how her body might be perceived or how it might be viewed with, you know, a potential partner, because she did want to pursue a relationship. That was something she wanted. So we did some work around, you know, how would her body be perceived? And she wanted me to see, you know, to see her without her trousers on or without her skirt on, she wanted me to tell her, you know, what I saw, you know, what I saw when I saw her, you know, her legs, what I saw when I saw her just in her underwear, because she, obviously, she was used to care workers seeing her like that, but not so used to anyone other than a carer seeing her like that. And I think, you know, for me, it was about being honest, so not in any way suggesting something different to what I saw, but being, you know, being heartfelt in that, that maybe I could see that, you know, she had thinness in her legs because she wasn't able to use her legs, but there was still shape in her legs. So that was a very tender piece of work with that particular client. And I do know, you know, the charity that I mentioned, they do fundraising events. And I met her at one of the fundraisers, and she was having a whale of a time.
Yes. Self-esteem.
I think just touching on something that you had talked about earlier, that kind of strikes me as an OT, is that not only are you looking at the individual and the person and what they're able to do or how you can, you know, help them physically achieve what they want to, but you're also looking at that environment piece. So it's not just the person, but making the environment sexy and making that environment a place that's welcoming to engage in sexual expression and sexual satisfaction.
Absolutely. And I think that was one of the biggest areas of learning for me. When I started to work with people with disability, it's the individual or it's the couple, but as importantly, it's their environment. Their environment being, you know, the actual physical environment in terms of, you know, medical equipment, wheelchairs, you know, special bed equipment, all of that. But their environment is also very much the people they rely on day to day. And that, I think, when someone with a person with a disability is wanting to explore their sexuality, I think that's one of their is quite a significant consideration for them. How are they going to be able to do that within the environment that they currently live in terms of they are going to need support. They are going to need to be able to, other people are going to need to know about this. It's kind of impossible for them to do it totally in isolation. And I think what I've learned is that we have to be respectful of the people who are working in that environment, because not everyone in that environment is comfortable with the idea of masturbation, is comfortable with the idea of, you know, people having sex outside marriage, is comfortable with the idea of paying for sex. And I think we have to respect that, you know, that there could be members of their, you know, care team, medical team, who have those views. So it's really having some very open conversations about, you know, who is okay with what this person wants to do and who is not, and not making them wrong because they're not okay.
Yeah.
You know, Fiona, and I think that's a big part of, you know, people exploring that wanting to explore their sexuality. It's a big part of it, feeling empowered to have those, you know, very adult conversations.
Yeah, I think that's a good place.
Yeah.
To end. Do you have any final maybe words of wisdom for anyone, for all people interested, whether it be future sex therapists or occupational therapy practitioners or whoever else might be listening, interested in this area of practice of sexuality and disability?
So I guess what I would say is, yeah, please don't be scared of, you know, of even opening up the conversation. And I think in opening up that conversation around sex and disability, don't assume anything. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think it's really important because we all, you know, both personally and professionally, we bring our experience, we bring our training, but we also bring our perceptions, and I think we can't possibly know. So it's to actually, don't guess it, ask.
That. Don't guess it, ask.
Yes. Well, thank you so much, Sue, for being on OT After Dark. It's absolutely wonderful. And thank you so much for all the work you are doing to empower individuals with disabilities in their sexual practice.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
I loved that.
I feel like I say this every time.
I know. I always say, that's the best one. That's great.
I don't think we ever have a bad episode.
No, that was fantastic. One of the things that really kept sticking with me is how much she sounded occupational therapy to me.
Oh, absolutely.
She's talking about changing the environment. She's talking about the social environment and how important that is.
All those contexts.
All the contexts that we consider, along with all the specific client factors and body functions,
I even caught a little activity analysis
There was a whole lot of activity analysis in there. So where can people find Sue, and where can people find all the wonderful things she was talking about?
She had a wealth of information and resources that we will, of course, share with everybody. Currently, you can find Sue at suenewsom.com. We will post a link to her website. On our website, but she is in the process of getting herself a new website.
It's the best named website ever.
Oh, okay.
I love it. sexualconfidence.com.
Can't wait for your new website, Sue.
I'm surprised that domain wasn't taken.
You know what? But kudos to her for taking it. Also, we will link to the Outsiders charity that's based in the UK that she discussed, as well as the Sexual Health and Disability Alliance. And what else do we have here? The Association of Certified Sexological Body Workers, and the IPSA, which is the International Professional Surrogates Association, which is actually based out of the United States.
So take a look at those websites. They're very interesting.
Yeah, lots of information about sex therapy as well as sex surrogacy and sex and disability.
And don't forget, sex is an ADL. Cheers!